Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. This is Margaret Sass interviewing Bob Young here on campus on 14 January. Bob, I mentioned that what I wanted to go into with you was how you got into working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and a little bit about your background before you entered it. Could you kind of fill me in there?
Well, I suspect so. I graduated from the University of Illinois in 1935, and I attended anthropology and linguistics, and originally I intended to go to Mexico because I was interested in Uto-Aztecan languages, and specifically Aztec or Nahuatl. But circumstances prevented going to Old Mexico, so I decided I'd come for a semester to New Mexico and see how things looked here, see if I was interested. And I did, and then I came here and enrolled in graduate school in 1935 at the University of New Mexico, and promptly became interested in Athabascan languages instead of Uto-Aztecan languages. So
amazing.
the Albuquerque Indian School made Navajo informants available, so I began work on Navajo and decided that I would use Navajo as a base language for comparative purposes, and at that time I was particularly interested in tracing ethnic movements through linguistic relationships. One of those things that people become interested in at that period in their life, and it sounded very interesting. But in the meantime, or in the course of time, between 1935 and 1940, I became acquainted with John P. Harrington, a senior ethnologist and linguist at the Smithsonian Institution. And he was interested in some of the same subject areas I was. So I began to work with him, looking toward the possibility of going up to Canada and up to Alaska and doing work up there based partly upon foundation material developed down here.
Tracing the background, in other words.
Yes.
For the Athabascan.
Yes.
Still with the Athabascan languages. Uh-huh.
Well, in the late 1930s, the Bureau of Indian Affairs became interested in exploring the possibility of using native languages as a medium for communication of ideas with adult non-English speaking members of tribes. Several tribes, the Sioux, the Navajo, Papago, and a variety of others. As far as I was concerned, I was primarily interested in Navajo. And they were in contact with Dr. Harrington, and through that contact, in the preparation of early bilingual materials and that sort of thing, I got acquainted with Dr. Beatty, and in 1940, Dr. Beatty offered me a position in the Bureau of Indian Affairs as the I think I was specialist in the Navajo language. That was in 1940. And I was primarily concerned with the development of bilingual instructional material for use in the schools. And it was produced largely in Phoenix, where they had a print shop in connection with the vocational school. So I would produce material and then go down to Phoenix initially to oversee its printing, to make sure that they spelled the words properly and got all the sentences arranged properly and that sort of thing. But I found that it would have taken forever down there to get anything done whatsoever, because they just had some Indian students in the print shop, and they didn't know how to set type in any language very well, and most assuredly they didn't know how to set type in Navajo. So I learned how to run a Linotype machine quite rapidly. And so I set the type on the stuff that we produced. And
what, do you have to hand set that?
No, by a linotype machine.
I see.
Well, anyway, it wasn't long after 1940, of course, that World War II was looming. And the situation was beginning to change here, even on the eve of the entry of the United States into the war. And there arose a need to inform Indian people about what was taking place and to inform them about the requirements that might attach to them if they went outside the reservation to work. And of course more and more work opportunities were beginning to develop very rapidly after 1940 for Navajo Indians. So with William Morgan, who was my assistant, we began to develop quite a range of adult materials as well as bilingual materials for use by children in elementary grades. One thing I remember we produced, I don't recall the date now, the publication of the thing, but it was called Dik Aranai Gibahane, The Story of the Present War. And
wow.
What it was a translation of a document that had a name that probably was something like that. And we secured permission from the publisher to publish it in Navajo. And it was published in Navajo. And although not very many people could read Navajo, some could. And those that could read it to people that couldn't read. And they did get some idea of the antecedents of the conflict and just what was going on. Then, to continue to meet adult needs, sometime, might have been 1942, 43, I can't recall the dates now, we began to publish a newspaper in Navajo, and we called it Atahon Neshigi, and it was published once a month, and of course it gave all sorts of information, not only information relating to the progress of the war, but also information regarding rationing and food stamps and all of the other things mm-hmm. that it was necessary for people generally to know during the war years. And during the same period, there was a terrific demand on the part of employers of Navajos outside the reservation for some sort of dictionary. Something they thought they could use to learn enough Navajo to communicate with the workers that they hired and with whom they couldn't speak. So this led to the development of a sketch of Navajo grammar and a dictionary called the Navajo Language.
Now, excuse me, I'll interrupt just for a minute. There was no dictionary before this time?
None that was of practical use, no. There were vocabularies mm-hmm. and the ethnological dictionary, as it's called, that had been produced in previous years at St. Michael's, Arizona. But these dictionaries and vocabularies were of no use to anyone who wanted to learn Navajo for practical purposes.
Right.
It'd be rather complicated for me to explain to you why, but
you can try.
Well, Navajo, the Navajo verb is a very complex element, a linguistic element, and the inflection of the verb is very complex. So if you are given one form, unless you know Navajo, you have no way of determining what the rest of the forms are for the same paradigm.
There's no root, in other words.
Yes, there's a root, but what you have is a root, and the root is carries a verbal meaning in sort of abstract form. Then that verbal meaning is modified by a number of prefixed elements. And these prefix elements are, some of them are adverbial, some of them indicate mode, some of them indicate tense, aspect, subject pronoun, the object pronoun. All of these things are bound up in the verbal construction. Well, this would be relatively simple, perhaps, if it followed regular rules of construction, mm-hmm. but it doesn't. When these several elements combine, they undergo what is called morphophonemic change. They no longer look like they did when they were separate and independent. So there are so many of them and so many potential combinations that unless, as I said, you knew Navajo, if I gave you one form, the probabilities are you couldn't determine what the rest of them were. So you would be stuck with whatever form I gave you. Well, the dictionaries that were available at that time gave only one form and gave no clues to how to develop the rest of them, so they were useless. Useless from practical from a practical point of view anyway. So what we did in our dictionary was make the entries in the form of the stem, and verbs, the stems have many sublative alternates too. It's something like sing, sang, sung. They have different shapes as they relate to different modes and different aspects. Well, we gave the stems in a consistent order, and then we gave the first person of each pertinent mode, or sometimes aspectual form, and then parenthetically, we gave the paradigmatic prefixes, which are the ones that mark person, so that anyone looking up a word in the dictionary could then look at the parenthetic information, and he could determine how to inflect this particular verb paradigm. And it was more usable, of course, from a practical point of view. I can show you what I mean if you want to turn your little machine
sure.
on for a second. There are two third person subject pronouns. One of them is be, and the other takes the shape J within the verb paradigm. And the difference, there are many differences. One of the differences between the two is that J is somewhat less direct. It's more perhaps comparable to one
like
in
the
English.
French, like the French on, would it be?
Something like yeah,
oh,
that,
like
yes.
That. Uh-huh.
Then, let's see, J is a polite form, and it used to be required between brothers and sisters, for example, after they had reached puberty, to impose something of a barrier, obviously related to the concept of incest. Mm-hmm. You maintain a distance from certain of your kinfolk. So instead of saying, really, what do you want, the question would be, what does one want? And this set up something of a barrier. Mm-hmm. Then in narrative, J is often used for the most important personage or character in the narrative to separate to distinguish him pronominally from another third person. So in the narrative, one can then use a pronoun without the necessity of repeating the noun, because he remembers the character to which J initially referred. And since he'll always be J, then you know which of two third persons you're speaking about. In English, as you know, it very frequently happens that a person in recounting something will use he, and since there are several third persons, finally the listener becomes confused and can't remember who he is, and he'll say, he, what, which he do you mean?
Right.
And
right.
In Navajo, this is precluded by the use of two third person pronouns. So that those are the major aspects of differentiation between the two third persons.
And
since the written language is so recent, they would have used this in their